Hi, Richard Feidler here, and thanks for downloading this special music conversation. We've had to edit the songs from this podcast in line with Australian copyright law. So if you want to track down the music and hear it in full, you can find the song track titles listed on our website. Go to abc.net.au/conversations. Thank you. Go ahead and enjoy. In 1979, Chris Murphy was managing a booking agency for rock bands. He went to see a band called In Excess play in a club. In Excess were at the time a band made up of three brothers and their best friends. They'd started out in Perth as a cover band and then slowly developed their own distinctive sound, a kind of funk-based, Talking Heads-influenced sound with strong rock and roll guitar riffs. Chris Murphy agreed to become their manager on the condition that they were prepared to become one of the biggest bands in the world, to break records. And not surprisingly, the band agreed. And that's pretty much what happened. Chris Murphy has often been asked how he did it. The answer is he did it with a mixture of perfect manners, politeness, great tact, and a delicacy for other people's feelings. Actually, he may have played things a little harder than that. Michael Hutchence once described him as In Excess's evil alter ego, which must have pleased him since the quote is actually on the back cover of his book, which is an autobiography simply called Murphy. Chris Murphy, welcome.
Hello, Richard. That was fabulous.
I heard your management style, well, your style when you're not happy about something in a deal is you get on the phone and you don't stop talking until you get what you want. Is that a fair description?
I learned that was my technique, but I actually didn't perfect it as my technique. I mean, in my younger days, because I was so young and I started managing Excess, I did read a lot of business business books, but I didn't realise until we were renegotiating the In Excess deal, that actually was the deal that got Kick and all the other albums back. When I was with my lawyer, and we're in London, this very plush room, and the international president for Polygram was there and the business people there, and it was a pretty high-to-do place. And I kept slamming my hand on the desk about masters and control and the band getting their copyrights back. And eventually they all sort of gave in. And then I walked out and my lawyer, and he goes, and he said, I can't believe you. You just keep talking and talking and talking until they give in and you just won't stop. That was the first time I'd ever actually realised that I was actually doing it, but I never actually applied it as a tactic. I'd like to think more it's if I'm passionate about something, I'm not going to give up until I win the point.
Your early years were in a housing commission house in Shell Harbour, which is somewhere on the New South Wales South Coast area. What do you remember that housing commission house that you spent your first years
in? What do I remember? Mm. Paradise. Absolute paradise.
Why?
Because we were in a community. A lot of the families were all at the same age. We all sort of grew up together. I had some of the best surf beaches in Australia, just two blocks to the east and to the south. I had cows in a paddock. We used to walk on the fence. It was a diamond-shaped fence. It had a pointy end, so it was quite hard to walk on. So we used to have competitions all the time of who could actually get far enough in the fence. And when we used to buy paddle pops, we used to keep the sticks. So when it rained, we'd all run out in the rain to the gutter and we'd have paddle pop stick races. I mean, there was no computer game in sight. We all had no money. But you know what? We didn't even know we didn't have any money. We didn't know the hardships our parents might have been going through. But I thought it was just paradise. We played football. You went to the swimming carnival. And quite frankly, I feel sorry for the kids today that their life revolves around a computer game and, you know, in a sense, false entertainment.
Your dad was working for a while as a truckie for Brambles.
Yep.
And then he shifted into the theatrical business, the entertainment business. That's How did he make that shift, Chris?
Well, they joined the North Shell Harbour Lifesaving Club, and my father got the job of booking a band for the Stomp. So he started approaching the bands, and every single band he approached told him the same story. They'd been ripped off, they couldn't get work, and could he help? It was a very innocent, naive way that he went in to sort of help bands.
How were you doing at school in these young years?
Oh, I did atrociously. I kept the report card that my mother proudly brought out. I think it was my 21st birthday.
And what sort of things do they say on the report card?
Oh, you know, Chris is useless. I think there's a report card where it had naught for spelling or something. But, you know.
Do you think you were dyslexic? What we'd now call dyslexic.
I think I am a bit dyslexic, to be honest. Look, I think I was a lot of things. As I say to a lot of parents now, and they start talking about their children, and they've got to put them on drugs for, you know, attention deficits and this and that. And I used to say, listen, I often say, please, just can you hold back here for a second? Because I can tell you right now, if all these names of all these things was around when I was a kid, I would have been on every drug that you'd imagine. But you know what? I just had space. I had space to play in. I had space to burn up my energy. You know, I've got a really bad attention span. My mother used to sort of tell me, you've got to work really hard at school because your father can't read or write properly. But obviously I watched my father. He's a very intelligent man. And I think knowing that too, I always had this view is, well, I'm going to be in the entertainment business, so what do you need all this education for? I don't remember my father once saying, I've got this problem or whatever else. He's a bit like me, just got on with life and made the best out of it that you possibly can.
Did he ever take you on the road with him as he took touring acts around Australia?
Yes. I think I was about 10, I think. He came home from work one day and he said, son, I'm going to take you on the road for 2 weeks. And I can still remember saying, but what about school, Dad? And then he said, you'll learn more on the road with me in 2 weeks than you'll ever learn at school. And boy, did I. And that was with an exotic dancer, a very, what they used to call in those days, blue comedian, which means these days, I don't know what they call that, raw, rude. And I think it was like a Russian, what they call side act, which is now like juggling or whatever else. We got caught in dust storms and went out to all these little towns. I still remember it. It was very classic.
Your father was coaching the ice hockey team. You were part of that team as well. So September 1969, you're playing the B grade final. Tell me what you remember of that day, Chris.
Well, it started off with me standing out the driveway like a puppy dog, waiting for my father to come home at Shell Harbour. We packed up the car and we all went off together. My sister, Shan, did a figure skating exhibition that night. And then the game began. And on this particular night, I'd scored a goal and suddenly I've jumped off the ice to have a rest and my father's sitting there. So, and he just looked up and he said, good goal, son, like that. And I said, oh, yeah, thanks, Dad. Next minute, he's gone off on the ice, and minutes later, he's down. And next minute, there's ambulance and things and whatever else.
What did you think had happened?
Well, quite frankly, in those days, ice hockey's so tough.
You thought he'd been hit then?
You know, didn't know. He'd just been hit, you know, been taken away.
Did you go to the hospital
as
well?
No, 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 I played on.
You played on.
Yeah.
What happened when the game finished?
All I remember is that I was in the change room, which was in those days was just a big sort of curtained off area. I heard this big guy say, oh, yeah, I hit that guy really hard, but I didn't think I hit him that hard to send him to hospital. And I looked up because I was a bit of a kind of like, did you hit my dad sort of thing? And but then I just looked down and I remember just looking down and thinking, well, whatever. I got taken to one of the other players' houses. And I was flirting with girls. There's a couple of really attractive girls there. And, you know, it's just, you know, just waiting to be picked up, to be taken home. And then when my mother arrived, it was like, your father's dead. And then come on, jump in the car, let's go home. So I was like.
What, just like that? Just like that?
Pretty much so. I mean, it's pretty cowboy stuff.
What did he die of?
A heart attack.
Your poor mum, what state was your mum in when she?
My mother was just in shock. She had three kids. And, you know, she was just in shock.
And how are you handling things on the drive home?
I was terrible. I was terrible. I think my two sisters were too probably young to really fathom what was going on, but I was in the front seat screaming, like, you know, what are we going to do now? What are we going to do now? I mean, this is my hero. This is my life. This is everything. And it just, you know, someone said, that's gone. My mother just, you know, had hold of the steering wheel saying, I don't know. I don't know. When I think back and go, no one drove us home. Why were we even allowed to go home? I mean, the next morning, my mother asked my neighbour up the road, a guy called Gary Griffith, to take me surfing, to take me away, to get me out of the house.
You said you got the sense that, you know, family and friends were watching you closely at the funeral.
Yeah, that was really bizarre, actually. I remember very clearly standing at the funeral. And when the coffin was going in, and I was very conscious of whether I could cry or not. I was very, very conscious of it. And I remember that very clearly, going, I shouldn't cry because these people expect me now to be the man of the family or to be tough. And I was unsure of what I was supposed to do.
Was there a moment later when you were able to cry?
I think I cried it all out last year, to be honest, Richard. Look, I'm sure there's been lots of times. I remember being in London, it was maybe a few years after Michael Hutchins passed away, and I was with somebody I knew very well, and we're having a drink somewhere and started talking, and this person said to me, "God, you haven't got over Michael's death yet." And I said, "Beg your pardon?" I said, "I haven't got over my father's death." And to be honest, I don't think I should get over any death. I don't think anybody should get over the death. It's something, what does it mean? Like those days in the cowboy films when they used to say, go out the back there and leave him out there for 4.5 days and bring him back and he'll be over it. So I just got on with life.
Were you harder afterwards?
Oh, yeah, without doubt. I don't know how other people treat it or how they respond to it. But if you go through that level of pain, there's nothing like it. I've had every bone in my body broken. I've had head smashed. I've had a lot of things. There's no pain like the pain of the heart. When you experience that, you're very scared to have that sort of pain again. So I think through my life, to be honest, if I ever went into allowing myself to be connected to something, whatever it may be, if I felt uncomfortable, something's going wrong, I'm probably the first to pull away because you just don't want to actually experience it. It's a definite thing. And writing the book last year, I got a pen, got some water and, you know, went down to where my pool is and sat under the little cabana and went, okay. And I just wrote down the word the beginning or the end, and I hadn't consciously thought about it. And I sat back and looked at it and I thought, the beginning or the end? That's really it, isn't it? The day my father died, was that the beginning of my new life or is that the end of a previous life? And I thought, well, I actually made it the beginning of my life. I treated my father's death and his memory as my guardian, in a sense. And the words he said, good goal, son, that was my aspiration to live up to. So when I started writing it, I must admit I was writing like that, and I could just feel the, we'll be careful here, you know, the tears coming down my eyes. And that happened all year because not only I had to rewrite it, I mean, when you send these things to these editors, I don't know if they don't understand what it's doing to you. Can I keep sending it back? I've changed three words. Could you read it again? It's like, oh, no. And I'd be sitting there reading it and the same thing. And then they go, oh, no, just change a few more words. Can you read it again? And they don't tell you which three words you've changed. So you've got to read the whole thing. I must have read that first chapter so many times. And I always remember being in a hotel room in, what was it, March 2012, and I got one of the editors sent through that again, the first chapter, and I was sitting in the hotel room going, oh, my God, how many times am I going to cry? Then I actually realised this is actually really good. And then all the scripts came in for the TV series and that, you know, reading about that, I was like, so 2013, I cried more in that year than I had in my entire life. That was a big year for me to get through. Tough. I couldn't do it again. I could not do it again. But this year, I now wake up every morning going, God, I feel so happy. And it's quite a bizarre feeling. I wake up every morning. I can't even sleep at the moment. I just wake up going, I'm so happy. So taking yourself through the reality, I'm so glad I put myself through it. I lived by myself the whole year, and it was challenging, but I'm the one that got the reward from it.
So there you were at 14 years old, and you'd lost your dad. And it was up to your mum now suddenly to pick up the family business herself. Did she have to kind of train herself on the spot, Chris?
Well, I mean, when I think about it, my mother was a housewife and financially not doing it easy. And suddenly she loses her husband and she's got me at 14, a little brat. My mother's sister is 11 and mother's sister's 7 at the time, I think, three of us. And literally on the next day she had to make a call to stay in business or not, because the vultures started already circling into my father's business. And my mother just, by Monday, was a theatrical booking agent. And I just think, God, what a woman. I mean, it's made her a tougher emotional woman in life, what she's been through, and it's been a bit harder for us kids. I know that my sisters haven't still actually understood yet the full understanding of when you go through so much hardship, how much that hardens you up. But I've learned to really understand it about my mother and just see all the great things she's done.
So you got the opportunity to work for your mum in the business, the family business, and then you jumped. You said yes. You're only 17 years old, and you had to make yourself look older than you were because you have to carry a certain amount of gravitas in that job. But how did you make yourself look older than your 17 years, Chris?
Oh, I started growing a beard straight away because I often thought if anyone knew how young I was, I'd have a heart attack with the responsibility that I had. My mother trained me in the same way that I train people these days and said, there's your desk, there's a phone, there's a book, there's a pencil. Now, go off and do some bookings. I analysed at all of 18 I was, my mother's artists, and I started coming up with the idea of packaging the artist. The one artist was called Warren Williams that had a couple of hit singles or something. And I realised if I packaged up the artist and made it the Warren Williams Show, instead of him earning his $120, I could then sell the show for $270, which meant they made more money, we made more commission, and it gave the artist more control over having a quality show.
You booked Richard Clapton on a tour around northern New South Wales and nearly killed the both of you. How did that happen, Chris?
Well, I was desperate to get into the rock side. Richard Clapton just had a song called Girls on the Avenue, which is a hit single. I don't even know how I got him to allow me to do it. I don't know, what, I was 19 or something. I came up with this idea of doing a country tour. And, and off we went. And I hired a, what do they call, Valiant Station.
Chrysler Valiant Station Wagon, fine vehicle.
Yes. And to put some gear in the back and the musicians in the front and in the back. And I was the driver. And Richard was an extremely nervous passenger. We got into, I think it was Tamworth. We played. I couldn't even book a venue, and I actually booked him into the cinema. Anyway, we jump in the car, and just Richard kept playing the Steely Dan, Steely Dan. In those days, there's no headphones. So in the car, and I'm concentrating driving. Richard's asking me to slow down all the time. Slow down, you're going to have an accident. So eventually, we're going just outside of Byron Bay. It started raining. We go around the corner. And I spun the Valiant out and went over a ledge that was going to, if this car was going to go down, it was only going to stop when we're all dead at the end. So the car was balancing and I took control of, whatever it was, 18, 19, and I said, now, everybody, stay still, do not move, thinking that if you move the car, because it was balancing. And everyone, the musicians all went, fuck you, and got out of the car and left me there. And I thought, okay. I think I just learned my first lesson.
About the music business.
About the music business, loyalty.
So they left the car and did the what happened to the car then?
Oh, look, I think I just slowly put the handbrake on, whatever it did, and just slowly go to the car. And that was the day before mobile phones and things, so we had to wait for hours and hours till the local farmer turned up with a tractor. We finally pulled it out, but boy, did I ever hear the end of it. I mean, Richard Clapton probably still sells Surrey today. I'm sure he does.
By 1979, you had your own booking agency, booking acts all over the place. Tell me about that night you saw NXS play live the first time.
Yeah, well, strange experience because I'd just done a tour of New Zealand with Midnight Oil. And Midnight Oil wasn't happy about the venues they were playing and they weren't very happy with their manager who wasn't on the tour, Gary Morris. And when I came back, Gary Morris came into the office. I think it was on a Friday night, probably the night I saw NXS, I think. And I said, Gary, you want to be careful. Your band's not happy with you. And he said, oh, and he mentioned he's got to really concentrate Midnight Oil. He's going to see, he's just discovered God, but he's got a big problem. He's got this band that he picked up called INXS and he doesn't know what to do with them. Then would I come down and see them? Anyway, I went down and saw them that night. And I watched them. And I went and tapped him on the shoulder about the fourth song and I said, yes, Gary, I'll take them. He immediately thought I meant take them for management. I meant take them as a booking agent because in my day, being an agent was a trade. To be a manager was a trade. So to cross trades to me wasn't something that you even thought of.
Did they want you to manage them?
Yes, they did. They came in and said, were you managers? And I said, no, I don't do management. And that went on for weeks about them asking to manage and me saying, no, I'm an agent. My father's an agent. That's what we do for trade. And plus, I've always been a sports person. So if I'm not surfing, I'm riding horses or playing something. So the idea of running around with rock bands on the weekend didn't really appeal to me.
So what changed your mind?
Personality and grit. Tim Farris, who still is one of the most wonderful men on the planet, and the elder Farris, I reminded him just recently, if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't have taken this journey together. Because he just grabbed me one day and he goes, can we at least have a barbecue together and get to know each other as people? And there was something about that that, you know, really sort of got me. And I said, yeah, sure. And we had the barbecue and I actually fell in love with them as people. I thought they're great people. And what people in the music business still haven't learnt yet, you can have all the talent in the world, but if you don't have great people to work with, it's all a waste of time. So
it's horrible. In fact, it's horrible unless you're working with great people.
Exactly.
It's a horrible business by and large, I think. But
it is.
And unless you're working with lovely people.
I've got a really strong rule about it, to be honest. And I've given contracts back to bands on the spot. I mean, when we had Ruart, because we signed a lot of different bands, and I'm not going to mention their names, there was a band that had like a 4.5-star review in Rolling Stone in America. And everyone said this is going to be the next band. And I heard about them complaining about someone or something in the office or something anyway. And I can't remember if I called them in. I pulled out I asked the lawyer, I said, where's the contract? And they said, there's the band, there's your contract. And everyone said, you can't do that. They're going to be the biggest band in the world. And I said, I can guarantee you they will not be the biggest band in the world. Because the biggest bands in the world have people with that actually have great work ethic and actually smart people and are down to earth. And that's been pretty much proven over and over again.
So you had your meeting with them. You brought them into your tiny office, as it was then, in a dungeon of an office, and you brought all six of them.
Three in the front and three in the back.
Three in the back.
True.
So you brought them into that and sat them down, the members of INXS. What was your pitch to them then?
I just told them. I said, look, I've thought about this. I think you're good guys, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Explain to them about work ethic, how hard I'm going to push them, and said that I'd sort of worked through Cold Chisel and Angels. They were my star bands when I was a booking agent. And I just said, I don't want to do it in Australia. I can do that. That was a pretty cocky thing to say. I was all the 25, by the way. And I said, I'll only do this on the basis that you'll do it. And I said, I'd like this in a very systematic way, and an international band, and not just be an international band, but make the history books. Because no Australian bands ever made the history books in those days. Obviously, AC/DC has.
So you sat them down and said, I'll only manage you if you're prepared to be an international band and not just an international band, one that breaks the history books.
Yeah, makes the history books.
Makes the history books. And what happened when you said that?
Michael, God bless him, put his hand up like a school kid and goes, yes, yes, like at school, like me, miss, me, miss, me, mister. Then basically one by one, they all sort of folded, and except for Andrew, who was a little bit more apprehensive about the whole process.
A band has to want this, doesn't it? This is the thing. I remember the Stone Roses were one of those bands that weren't up to it. They weren't. The success was about to come their way, and they might have been the flag bearers for the whole Britpop phenomenon, but they weren't ready for it. Maybe they didn't want it enough, and they fell down, and eventually Oasis picked up.
Yeah, look, I think there's two parts to the story. Professionals blame it on the musicians, but I don't think it's all the musicians' fault. Because number one, I don't know how I'm going to do this on a global scale, because if I can get everyone to focus on it, it'll save a lot of people's lives. Because, Richard, what people don't realise is when people take on the job of managing a band or working with an artist, they're actually taking on the responsibility of someone's life. And then if they get it wrong over a 4 or 5 or 8 year period, that person's life can be ruined forever. And not only that, the expectations of an artist of wanting to be big and then not being big, that's a pretty big burden to have to carry for the rest of your life. My view is that not enough professionals actually sit down with the artists and actually explain to them the full gamut, the bad parts, the good parts. When you have success, the cockroaches that come out with the drugs, the groupies, the whole thing that goes along with it. As I say to any parents that I meet, it's sex and drugs and rock and roll. It's sex and drugs and rock and roll. Don't think anything else. And if your son or daughter does not have their head together and does not understand the pitfalls and the hard work that's got to go into it, there'll be havoc to play.
Do you like musicians? Do you like being with them? Do you banter with them after gigs?
Oh, yeah, no, yeah. Look, I just been in London with Tim Farris. We had a ball and we giggled and laughed and whatever else. And it's funny, I was talking to someone this morning about a band that we'd just re-established our publishing company, and they're our first signing. And I was telling someone who rang me from LA this morning who's fallen in love with this band and wants to do something with them, and she said, what are they like as people? And I said, you know what? My first proper meeting with them the other day went for 14 hours, and I could have gone another 6 hours because they had me in hysterics. And I had dinner with them on Friday night before they played, and I said, I've never laughed so much in all my life. So if they like me and we get on well, that's fantastic. But my view, first view is I want the musicians to respect me. My job is to get them through. It's a tough friggin' business. It's a really tough business. So as I said to a band that rang me yesterday, and they asked me about something, I said, look, you've got to have a meeting with me for at least 3 hours to even slightly understand me, because you possibly won't like me.
When you saw NXS and when you were with them, three brothers and their friends, that's a good way of describing it. What was the working relationship like between those six different men? What did you observe of them as a group?
They were a little bit like a gang. There was a harmony about them. Everyone was the same as everybody else. There was no clarification of who was best and not best. And there was a loyalty to each other. You never felt once that they were going to break up. And after being the agent for many, many bands where, you know, somebody used to come in and the bass player was changing, they had a new drummer and they had a new guitar player, you never felt that they were going to break up. There was just this, a strength. They went out on the road, worked really hard and had fun.
On ABC Radio, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler, on air, online, and on your mobile.
Chris Murphy was a booking agent for rock and roll bands like Cold Chisel and the Angels in the late 1970s. When he saw a band called NXS, he became their manager, and those guys went places. Chris has written a biography called Murphy. So they put out their first album, then a second album, and a third album, which was Shabu Shabar, which had that song, The One Thing. Mm-hmm. And there's that great film clip where they're sitting down at a banquet for The One Thing. What's the story behind that film clip?
It was actually an American guy who associated through Michael's family, and he came out to Australia, he's from the film industry. That's right, he was a film editor. And he started getting into my ear all the time about, you know, doing a video, and he'd like to do a video and blah, blah, blah. And eventually he said, if the band's going to have a name called NXS, well, they better start acting like NXS. And one day, actually, you're right. He came up with this idea, I think he did, of doing this whole thing with it being NXS and being rock and roll at a banquet. And anyway, in the end, I let it go and all the pretty girls came in, and that's when they did that thing of eating the figs.
Yeah, eating the figs and eating with their hands, and there's cats walking across the meal.
Well, luckily, no one picked up on us when the whole these girls taking the cut, you know, have a look at the fig, and eating this fig out. And it was just when I had the interest from America, and I took the first video to MTV, and it was just spot on. It was just beautiful timing all around.
You saw the need to get them on MTV, and this is around about the time when MTV was just becoming a thing, wasn't it? You said you went over to America, saw what MTV was starting to do, and then came back to Australia almost straight away. What was the plan then?
Well, about a year or so, I think, before all this, my middle sister, Sian, used to work with us. She was actually the band's personal manager. There was another guy called Gary Grant who had joined us as a sort of tour manager capacity. We had this place at Mossman where we were renting, and we had our office there. That's all we could afford. And I took him out the back on the lawn one day and I said, we're making a mistake. My expertise is live touring. Sian, your expertise is live touring. Gary, your expertise is live touring. We don't know in the future whether your band is going to play in Tokyo and it's going to get beamed all around the world by a satellite or something. One of us better start to learn about that side of technology. So I started watching a lot of, you know, understanding tech, trying to understand where technology was going and watching things. And I was, although I was very bad at school, I was actually a fantastic researcher. So when I went to America and they said, there's a thing called music television starting, it was just spot on. I got it straight away. So then I heard a thing called New Wave. It was coming out of England, The Police and U2, et cetera. So I flew from New York, got to LAX, rang the office and said, make sure the band is in the office when I get there. I'm not even going to shower. I'm going to straight into a meeting. We went straight into a meeting. And I said, guys, we're going to America. We're going to America now. And I said, we're going to pretend we're a New Wave band. We're going to pretend we're coming from England. And we're going to catch this MTV wave. And we've got to go now, because what's going to happen, once all the other managers and bands and record companies pick up, there'll be a flood. So we have to play and play. And one thing I knew about America, and English people didn't, and Australian people didn't, is that they really respected musicians, bands, people that could play. So I knew if we could prove ourselves in excess, because they were great musicians and were a real band, they would establish themselves. And goddamn, I'm glad I did that.
Did NXS look Australian to an American audience?
No. We had a few tricks. Michael was raised in Hong Kong. He went to Hollywood High for a year. So Michael always sounded a bit posh. And in Australia, that made him a wanker. So what I used to do in the early stages is put Michael on the phone. So in the end, a lot of people, if you go to Americans, they probably don't remember now, would say, I didn't know those NXS were Australian. I thought they were England. And so we sort of tricked it a little bit and covered it up because the Australian bands no band had really perfected the credibility side. I mean, AC/DC hadn't broken at any level that stage. So we hadn't had a band that, you know, that the Americans could say rock and roll. So, yeah, look, NXS didn't look Australian, and we went out of our way not to look Australian. I never used the term once, the biggest band in Australia. And every band that comes out of Australia, came out of Australia and still have a bit of a tendency to do today, try to use Australia as a selling point. Well, guess what? Americans don't really care if you're Australian. They care if you're good.
NXS toured for a while as support for Adam Ants and then for the Go-Go's. I remember the Go-Go's. They were great in their day. Is there a moment you can name when NXS finally got picked up? You heard them on the radio or something. What was it the moment when you thought it's starting to catch on? It's starting to catch fire.
Look, when NXS first got to America, we had the MTV thing. We got the one thing on, the band, they got into high rotation. So during the Adam Ant tour, they were starting to knock Adam Ant around severely as a band and on stage. So suddenly out of 5,000 kids who were MTV kids from watching Adam Ant, suddenly from the first show, which were 5,000 people there to see Adam Ant, halfway through the tour, the 5,000 had switched.
Right. So they're taking off in the United States. And meanwhile, back in Australia, and I love this story, the Narara Festival, which we'd all forgotten about, was the biggest rock event of its rock festival of its time at the time. And they wanted NXS along with big headline acts like Talking Heads and The Pretenders.
Simple Minds.
Tell me the story of that festival and NXS's appearance at that
Narara
Festival.
I'm really proud of myself. There's really two things I was super proud of. There's that, and there's when I cancelled the band off the David Bowie tour. Because what happened is NXS had just come off the back of the Swing tour where we'd had Original Sin was number one. And the Narara people had booked whoever the headline, Simple Minds, you know, three international acts. But for some reason, they didn't feel it was complete without NXS. They started calling me, we want NXS. And I said, well, it's fine. Well, as long as it's equal billing. And they said, oh, look, I'm really sorry. These are international bands. Now, that's like waving a red flag to a bull.
So what they were saying to you was the biggest headline acts on the poster would be Simple Minds, Pretenders, Talking Heads. They'd have the biggest, the 100% font.
Yeah.
And then below that, it's at 80%, they were saying that's where they'd put NXS.
I think they offered us 70%. That was the biggest. And that's the biggest of all the Australians.
Right.
And you should be lucky you're getting that.
What did you think when they put that to you?
I probably would have said, fuck you, and hung up the phone. I was a bit of a phone slammer in those days because you can't do that with mobiles. That's too expensive.
So why wasn't that the end of that?
Well, they kept calling, and then they used agents to call and someone else to call, and it finally it came around. I can't remember who. Somebody came and saw me and sort of said, please, we'll pay you whatever it was. I can't remember. And they said, but we cannot give you 100% billing because we've contracted Ian Flukes. It's in the contract that no other artist gets 100% billing, so we can't even change it, even if we want to, Chris. Give us a break. And I said, okay, thank you, I'll get back to you. That night, I walked around the house, and then I eventually went, got it. Rang them the next day and said, I'll do it for this amount of money, but it's conditional that Inexcess's name is not on the poster.
Not in the marketing?
Nowhere whatsoever. And I said, I want whatever it was, 20 grand, and I will do our own marketing. And I said, I must have my own support, and I must play at sunset. And in the end, they just said, oh, he's crazy. He's crazy. We'll let him do it. So I did my own artwork, did my own poster, and it was Inexcess at sunset with special guest Sandy in the Sunsets. So we just drummed home sunset. Radio station started talking about it, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this was one of the greatest days in my life because Simple Minds walk around like they're big rock stars. David Byrne was walking around like he's a big rock star. I don't know where Chrissy Hynde was at the time. And all of a sudden the day, and these concerts, and it gets hot, and it gets everyone's getting burnt, and the crowd gets low, and they're getting drunk, and they're getting down and down and down. One thing I knew about sunset is sunset changes energy levels. So eventually, ladies and gentlemen, we had our own introduction, we had our own start, we had everything.
So like a separate gig within a gig.
We had a separate gig within a gig.
Right.
And eventually someone got up and said, ladies and gentlemen, from Japan, Sandy and the Sunset. And they got up there and they had a very groovy little band, did their thing. Then the sun starts dropping down and everyone starts waking up from their slumber and their alcoholism during the day and getting a bit colder and freshen up a little bit. And then all of a sudden, ladies and gentlemen, Inexcess. And Inexcess came on and the lights came on. And I can't remember if I got the band open with Don't Change or not. And the place went ballistic. I'll never forget it. I was on center stage. Suddenly David Byrne, all these guys came up. What's the commotion? What's the commotion? Oh, that's Inexcess, guys. And they were the hit of the night. It was fantastic.
They recorded The Swing, and Nile Rodgers produced the single from that, Original Sin. I had no idea that was such a quote-unquote controversial song in the United States, Original Sin. Just for that line, dream on white boy, dream on black girl, like it envisaged a kind of an interracial future. This was a real big deal in the United States.
Well, I was at a function, at lunch in America with the chairman of Universal Publishing and the president of Universal Publishing in America, and they said something about Original Sin, I love that track. And I said, Jesus Christ, that track nearly got me killed. They said, what happened? I said, well, Nile Rodgers came to a gig once and he said to the band that typical American thing about, hey, we should work together someday. I heard it. And I thought, I'll get you, you know. Anyway, I badgered him. I drove him insane to, I got him to record it. In fact, he didn't even know I'd booked the studio without even telling him at the power station. To one day I got a phone call saying, is that Chris Murphy? And I said, yes, it is. And Mr. Rogers for you. And I went, oh, hi. And he got on the phone and said, what the fuck are you doing? I said, hey, yeah, yeah, what's wrong? And he goes, you booked my fucking studio. You didn't book my fucking studio without telling me. I said, you said you wanted to work with the band. And he goes, I haven't even heard any music. And I'll get some music, but don't cancel the dates because the band are flying directly into New York to do it, which is a lie because they're coming to do a show. So I rang the band and said, guys, you got to write a song. I got Nile booked. It's all booked. And he goes, what? Yeah, next Thursday. It's all booked. On the bus, they wrote Original Sin.
On the way to recording it.
And Michael, as they were coming in, you know, into New York City, he's still writing the lyrics. You don't know when songs are written. Songs are written, you know, Need You Tonight, it was written while a cab was waiting
at
the front.
That's the truth. I mean, some of the best hit songs are all written within half an hour. That's pop songs anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This bullshit now that record companies put bands with co-writers, and that's why so much music's become so formulated. Anyway, to finish up the story, so I went into the studio one night, and there's Nile. And there's Daryl Hall doing backup vocals.
Hall did backup vocals.
Yeah, on Original Sin. Wow. Tommy Mottola's there, who at the stage was the head of, I don't know if it's called Sony or CBS. And I'm going, wow, this is all bloody big time action stuff. Anyway, we stop and play the track, and I go, wow, fantastic. I get the cassette, which is what it was in those days, and I had an office, one of the rorts I pulled off with the record company called ATCO, which is ATCO Atlantic, and the lady who was the head of that label, Reen Nally, who eventually originally signed the band. I used to go to her office every afternoon and play music, talk about the day, or get my music lessons. So I went in there one day, Reen, I'm going to hit record for you. I put it on, and she stands there, and I could see her face getting sour and sour. About halfway through it, she hits the stop button. She goes, what the f*** are you doing? I said, beg your pardon? She said, what are you doing? The band making black music. And I said, what do you mean black music? That's what Inixus do. They're a funk rock band. Anyway, they refused to release the record. They wouldn't release Swing. So Inixus's career at that point was finished in America.
Why was there this constant pressure on Inixus to drop the funk element of what they did in favour of straight up rock and roll? Why did they sort of want to turn them into, I don't know, Bon Jovi or something like that?
That is bizarre you said that. Because after Shabu Shabu was pretty much a rock album. And if you noticed, well, no one would notice, but I actually didn't. I heard the album in London and knew this is not going anywhere in Europe. I just knew. So we played America, but what happened is the band became quite big quite quickly in America. And I got really nervous that they were getting too comfortable and were going to like it. And then all we had to do is do another one of those albums and we're on the road to Bon Joviville. I didn't want to manage Bon Jovi.
You never interfered with their sound, though, did you? You never, like, you didn't sit on recording sessions, did you?
Never. No. You know, Original Sin was up there, I manipulated, but I'm not going to take any credit for it. So there's things that you do. I mean, quite frankly, when I saw the band getting very comfortable, Shabu Shabu, sorry, guys, you're going to hear this for the very first time, is I got really worried about them becoming Americanized. So first thing I did when the Shabu Shabu tour, I booked the band a tour in Europe. And they had to go and play all the shitty gigs in Europe. And the next album they record, I booked them into a studio in London. So they actually had to get up from America and go to London, which is where Swing was made. If you listen to Shabu Shabu and have a listen to Swing, there's two totally different albums. And the Swing was made to be much more to fit in with the European feel about it. And that's why it failed in America. But it helped in Europe. So we had to keep balancing up the band's career by sometimes with different musical styles.
You were given an audience with David Bowie in Japan. It was being floated that Inixus might go on tour, be part of the David Bowie show. Tell me about being admitted into the presence.
Well, it was funny. I was in Japan looking for locations to shoot the Original Sin video. I went along to this little club in Tokyo one night, and I'm standing in the middle, not many people. Someone goes, David Bowie's over there. Oh, it's Mr. Bowie. I said, oh, I don't really care. I don't really like his music anyway. So when it all finished, I was the international music man. Then David Bowie walked in and I was like an ant. You know what I mean? So he got rushed away backstage as the god, Mr. David Bowie. And I sort of got left there. Who's that got Chris Murphy guy now? And then eventually Sandy came down. She was very polite and said, Chris, why don't you come to the dressing room and say hello and meet Mr. Bowie? I said, look, I don't really care if I meet Mr. Bowie, to be really frank. And she said, well, come up anyway. And I walked into the dressing room and he was in the middle of the room sitting down holding court with everyone, you know, gawking at him. And they're all sitting down and there was no chairs left. So no one got up. So I'm standing there in the middle of a room. Can you just imagine? And everyone's looking, you know, saying, he said, oh, Mr. Bowie, this is Mr. Chris Murphy from Australia. And before I could say anything, he goes, oh, I'm Australia. I'm going down there to do an Australian tour. I said, yes, I heard. What he didn't know that I knew, he hadn't sold out. And I said, yes, I've heard. And he said, yes, yes, yes. Apparently there's this band called Ice House or something. The singer apparently wants to be me. And I was going, oh, yeah, really? Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't want a band on stage that thinks he's me. He goes, yeah, I'm thinking about having this band called Inks. And he doesn't know who I am at this stage. And I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, apparently they're pretty good and they're doing really well. And I said, yeah, they just sold, triple platinum. And I knew his last album only sold about 50,000 and we'd done triple platinum, which is 210,000, big difference. So he goes, yeah, I'm thinking about putting them on as the support. And I said, oh, really, are you? I said, I think they've sold more records than you down there. Still didn't give away who I was. He said, oh, well, I might just do them a little favour and put them on my support. And I said, a little favour, will you? So I said, oh, well, see how you go. And I never told him. So I go home and go to bed. Don't think anything of it. My phone starts ringing about 4 o'clock Tokyo time. And I pick up the phone. I get this screaming like a girl from a guy who worked for me. Go, did you meet David Bowie last night? And I went, yeah. And he goes, David Bowie is a god. I said, he might be to you, but to me he's just some guy who was being a bit obnoxious, to be honest. So anyway, he calls back and about 2 hours later or something. He goes, Paul Dainty's rang and wants NXS to be on the tour. I said, no, thank you. And he goes, what are you talking about? I said, Gary, he just sold 40,000 records. We just sold 210. We just sold out all the shows. This is we got to, NXS is going to be an international band. If we don't start thinking we're an international band, we can, and go off and do support bands to every international act, I don't care who they are. And I said, plus the guy hasn't sold out his shows, okay? And now what they want to do is use NXS to sell out the shows, but they want to pay us, what, 25 grand a show or something? And we have to sell out the tickets. It doesn't work that way in my world. So the phone calls kept coming and coming, and eventually I said, I'll make you a deal. Tell them that I will do it on the proviso that they cannot advertise one word of NXS and we'll do it as a surprise. Now, this is before social media could – so you could play in Perth and maybe a radio station in Perth might report it back to a Sydney radio station, but you could actually – you know, you didn't have this sort of overnight or in within seconds social media. So anyway, they all accept it and we did a deal, sign an agreement. And then I got a phone call. I'll never forget it. I can remember where I was sitting. Someone said, oh, it's Wayne from WA in Perth. He goes, Chris, I just heard the news. You're doing the David Bowie tour. I said, where did you hear the news from? And he goes, David Bowie arrived in Perth this morning for his first show and he's sitting there with Molly and they announced that NXS are doing the special guest. I said, they announced it at the press release. And he goes, yeah, press conference. So I hung up. I said, Gary, cancel the tour. He said, you cannot. And I did. And that was the first time I had NXS. I had everyone in my everyone in my office hated me. Tim Farris's wife, the only time in all, and to this day, only came and saw me and goes, I beg you, Chris. The band were coming at me. Everyone was coming at me. And I don't know how I did it. I just stood there steel-faced and said, no, principle, principle, principle. We're not breaking principles. If we're going to break our principles today, how are we going to break them? And we didn't do it.
Did anyone in the band support you in that?
I can't remember, Saul.
So they become one of the biggest bands in the world. NXS become massive. They have their album, The Kick, which was huge. It had Never Tear Us Apart, Need You Tonight, New Sensation. The guy at Atlantic Records hated it so much he offered you $1 million to go and re-record it. You pushed ahead. It was released anyway. It became a giant international album, massive album all over the world. Did that feel like victory?
I don't know when I let it be that. I think it was when it was around the time when I'd been Americans were starting. See, Australia don't we're not really respectful of entrepreneurs, particularly the music industry. But I was starting to get noticed by a lot of the record company executives, and I'd just been approached before Kick came out by a guy called Bob Krasnow to start a record label, and he was going to pay me a lot of money. And I said, no, I'm sorry, I can't do it because I've made a commitment to six young men and their families that I'm going to make them the biggest band in the world, and I haven't done it yet. And it was, I don't know how many weeks later, months, I don't know when it was, someone in my office said, my office, it was two people, said, oh, Chris, Mr. Bob Krasnow's on the phone. I picked up the phone, he said, you've done your job, so now you can start the record label. I said, what are you talking about? And he said, don't you know? And I said, no. What are you talking about? He goes, Chris Murphy, you manage the biggest band in America. You have the number one record, Need You Tonight. Don't tell me your record company hasn't told you. I said, you just told me. And he goes, let's meet next week for lunch. We can do a record company. And hung up. And I think that's probably the first time I sat there quietly by myself and went, oh, my God. My number one record in America. So, yeah, it was rewarding because I tell you, if that would have gone wrong, I would be living in a caravan now. There'd be no two ways about it.
Late 1988, the band said they wanted some time off. They'd been working very, very hard, as you'd intended them to do so, touring, recording, rehearsing, touring, recording, rehearsing. In the TV miniseries, Damon Herriman, who plays your character, walks in on this band meeting. They say, we want some time off, and he says he's pretty much disgusted and really flings it back in their face. Is that how it was? Were you genuinely disgusted, revolted by the idea of them taking some time off?
Oh, yeah, I just didn't even think that it was in anyone's mindset. I thought we were one for one and one for all. I mean, INXS were one of the hottest bands in the world. And also, there'd been this, EU2 had always been ahead of us, and it was like we smacked them and we got up on top. And, you know, it was a big moment. We were there. We were in the middle of, you know, rock and roll central. So when the band said that to me, they really caught me off guard. I was like, this is a joke.
Were you troubled when Michael Hutchins said he wanted to take on a side project that the band Max Q that he started up as a side project?
Yeah, look, I knew it was – look, to be honest, he was going out with an American girl at the time who was on his case all the time about being an actor and being – I could feel it. I could feel Michael's separation from the band. He started to separate from me. There was a bit of an attitude developing. The American girl was telling him he's the star of the band.
Yeah, that's inevitable, isn't it? That happens in every band, doesn't it?
Someone, but we did a pretty good job, to be honest, Richard, of – containing it. I'd done all my research. I knew what we're, and we did a really good job of containing it. And when this girl came in, and it got to a point where managing the band was, I mean, that was a big job. You couldn't really deal with all the nuances and, you know, Michael's nuances running over here and whatever else. Yeah. So, you know, when he came to me and said, I can't remember if he said something about a solo album. And I think the agreement I made with him was that he could work, but we can't use his name. Because once you use his name and do a Mick Jagger or a look at Brendan Flowers from The Killers, just killed the band off by doing a solo album. So quite frankly, I was able to contain it by creating Max Q and forcing it into – I made it an alternative cool project rather than Michael Hutchins does solo album and has the disaster.
1991, they went back to play at Wembley Stadium, sold out, massive thing. You had the idea that the whole thing should be filmed. How close to the wire was that?
Days out. I was running around in black cabs from one part of London to the other, begging the record company to put in money, running over here. And eventually I think it was Polygram Films I got to contribute, but I had to contribute. And that's that. I'm really sad that they edited that out of the TV series because it is one of the – and Wembley is now one of the band's moments, one of their pinnacles of their career. And one of the funniest things that happened – one of the things that really explains me and explains INXS's dedication to the big picture and not money is that when the band's on stage and John Farris is starting into Guns in the Sky and the band's run on, I'm standing side of stage and Michael came up to me and said, how much are we making for tonight? And I just looked him straight in the eye and I put my fingers together in the naught symbol.
Zero.
Zero. And Michael went, what? And he looked at the crowd like, what? And I went, mate, 12 cameras, a fucking helicopter, 35 mil, what do you fucking want? And he goes, you asshole, like that, and runs on stage into the best gig of his life. And I thought it was really sad they missed that out and they turned it into this where Michael just dropped pills, which is not true, and I didn't like that part. And I should have protested more about it because that was INXS and me at that moment. Chris Murphy took that risk all by himself without telling the band. So, you know, yeah, that was Wembley.
1992, the wheels are starting to come off. They were struggling to find a new sound there. You wrote that Michael arrived at the recording for the album and said, oh, sorry, I wrote the lyrics, but I left it in a cab. Not a great time. 1995, you resigned. What was that led you to that after all this kind of mad, insane, driving passion?
Yeah, look, a couple of things. There was a couple of things going on internally. You know, having Michael out there being a complete loose cannon, there was a disjointedness in the band. Where was the creativity going? I couldn't understand the creativity going. I wasn't a huge fan of that whole Capri thing. I thought was a really bad move. I thought the music they made on Full Moon Dirty Heart left a lot to be desired. I couldn't work out, you know, I had one solution for the band, which they all, you know, thought I was nuts. I still today don't think I was nuts and why I wanted to, because when I first met INXS, they used to do a lot of funk and a lot of ska. And I said to the guys, look, I think you should just go to Jamaica and make a really cool reggae album and at least lay that base of, you know, something different back. And they went to Capri. So But the biggest thing, realistically, I took custody of my daughters.
And what did they say when you told them that you'd resigned as INXS's manager?
Yeah, well, Stevie was born the year 1980, the year that that I started managing INXS. So Stevie sort of lived the whole thing. And also Michael's her godfather as well. And Michael used to take her on stage when we were in places like Japan and all that sort of put her on stage. So when I didn't even think about it too much. I was like, I'm a bit weird like this. I can just wake up one day and go, oh, okay, I'm doing this today. And I woke up, wrote a letter to Tim and said, look, mate, you know, this is it. I'm really breaking my contract, and off I go. And I went home and grabbed my two daughters, and Stevie was 15 at the stage, and I said, girls, I'm not doing a press release. I'm going out very quietly, but I've actually resigned from INXS, and you might have to deal with it at school tomorrow. And my Stevie said, looked me straight in the eye, got up right up front, and she said, good. They had you for 15 years, and now it's my turn. And that was the validation that I just made. And I never for 1 minute looked back on that decision once my daughter said that to me.
After you resigned, the band went on its own way. Did you ever speak to Michael again after you'd resigned?
No, I don't think so. I saw them. It was funny because I saw them at the ARIA Awards, and that was the night I was selling Ruart to BMG, and they'd call me to a press conference to announce it. And I remember it was weird, really, and I was walking on the right-hand side of the stage up there, and the band were walking on the left-hand side about to go on stage do, and I looked across, and thank God he didn't see me. I saw Michael with his white face and pale face and that black dyed hair that he had. And I just thought, oh, my God. And I went, just shook it off and kept walking. So
like seeing an ex-girlfriend in the street or something.
Good analogy.
Michael's death. What a horrible business. That's been gone on over and over again. I don't intend to go through the business of it now with you, obviously. But nonetheless, you write, interestingly, that he tends to pop up in very vivid dreams you have every once in a while.
Yeah, you know, look, since the TV show's come out, it's sort of been cool, to be honest. It's been okay. But I haven't had it. I don't think I've had it once. So I don't know if that, you know, going through living the scripts as I did as executive producer and overseeing everything and then seeing the edits and the edits and the edits where I had to cry my eyes out going through the whole process of the whole thing. I haven't had it, but by God, when he did, I used to wake up going, Michael's still alive. No, he's not.
What would he typically say or do in these?
But just chat. Michael and I, before Michael went a little bit, became a bit of a knob, I don't know where else to explain it, he and I had a great relationship. You know, in the only time I was managed Michael, I probably had one or two arguments with the guy, maybe five, maybe six, over 15 years. He was a great guy. He's a gentleman. He was funny. He was great to be around. He was entertaining. So when I've had those sort of visions, visits or whatever else, it's just us talking like we used to talk in those days.
There was this interregnum where you were away from INXS and Michael died and you set up and then sold Ruart, set up another world music label, Petrol, and you're a bit ahead of the curve with digital radio. Then Kirk and Andrew from INXS asked to have a meeting with you. What came out of that meeting?
I got a phone call, I think it was, you know, early 2009 or something, saying, remember that deal you did before you left where we get our masters back?
The master recording.
Yes. My first reaction is, that's really weird. I only thought about that the other day. When are those masters coming back? Now, what they didn't do is that I had sort of monitored a little bit when I was in London or travelling. I'd go into record stores and check, and I found that most of INXS's repackaged stuff I didn't really think was great, and they were now in the mid-price bins. And I used to think, oh, God, I worked my ass for 15 years on this brand, this band, and look where it's getting now. The long story is I took about 6 to 9 months to respond. If I come back, I could end up being like those prize fighters that go and retire and then come back fat and out of condition for the money. Their moment of greatness is then deteriorated by hours of stupidity. And I thought about it, and eventually, as everyone knows, I took it on and I took control of the band's master. So I became their record company more so than their manager. And I thought, well, INXS really have got to stop their touring. Or at that stage, they were not going to tour anymore.
They had a succession of replacements for Michael.
And when I came along, they'd had enough of you know, all this business. They weren't going to ever tour again. And I thought, fantastic, there's no problems to me. I don't have to run around with bloody gigs with you anymore. And then I developed this thing about, you're not a band anymore, you've got to become a brand. So there was this band to a brand. And I started literally writing notes about brand to the brand. And so anyway.
I think one thing people don't get about managers, good managers anyway, of Rock and Roll Acts, is that they're often seen as scheming, cynical, evil bastards, and maybe sometimes they are, but they absolutely have to be the number one fan of that band, don't they? They have to have a kind of almost obsessive cult-like love of that band.
They do. You know, these days what really frightens me is, and I discovered it when I was doing the original Sin album with all the guest singers, Ben Harper and Rob Thomas, etc., and I started approaching all the managers about, you know, finding the singers. And every time I looked on the websites, I found that some of these management companies maybe had 20, 30 bands. That to me is you're basically nearly a glorified booking agent. And they should change the name to management agency or something
else. And take 5% less too, perhaps, yes.
Yeah, look, to be honest, it's a hardcore call to actually put yourself out there. When people say, you know, God, you got on the plane and went to New York with $100 and you could have gone bankrupt and you did it over and over and over and you kept taking these risks. I guess I had so much faith in my band. And when I took this job on nearly 5 years ago, I got rid of all my businesses, all my jobs. I dropped down when I was doing petrol. I was having lots of success with digital books, with iTunes. I stopped all that to concentrate. So, you know, I hope if nothing else I've displayed for people, I don't really want the ego or the accolade from it. I like it when people say you've done a good job, but I prefer that people go, that's what you get when you're really passionate about something. Just take something on and take the risk and be passionate, and you'll be surprised what returns come out of it.
Chris Murphy, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.